This is Science Moab, a show exploring the science happening in Southeast Utah and the Colorado Plateau. I'm Peggy Hodgkins, and today we are talking about the humpback chub, a population of fish living in the Little Colorado River. Stay tuned. The Little Colorado River, or LCR, has a brilliant turquoise blue color due to the calcium carbonate minerals suspended in the water. Travertine, a chalky limestone that settles out of the water and coats the riverbed in a white hue, adds to the river's amazing color. The Little Colorado River can be divided into the upper and lower reach, which are divided by a series of travertine waterfalls.
The work I did kind of connected like the biotic with the abiotic, really like, I guess, intricacies of the LCR. And the more you start learning about those things, you're like, this is crazy. This is a ridiculous place. The background of the LCR is, I think it kind of really became like to conservationists and biologists, like very notable and important after Glen Canyon Dam went in upstream. Because when Glen Canyon Dam went in, the Colorado River, which normally, or pre-dam, would have been like warm and muddy, became cold and clear. And so that's not favorable to native fishes. While the Little Colorado River stayed warm, the thing about the calcium carbonate, or the thing I think that can be kind of counterintuitive to people who haven't seen it, is that it's this like bright blue color. And like when you look on pictures online and stuff, it's this bright blue color, but it's also highly turbid. So if you're standing, you know, up to your shins, you can't see the tops of your feet, even if though it's this like bright blue color, which I feel like is counterintuitive because we usually associate that kind of turbidity with like the chocolate milk mud down here.
The LCR is also one of the last remaining places where you can find the endangered humpback chub. We are talking today with Phoebe Brown, river guide and researcher, who as an undergraduate was part of a larger study looking at the growth rates of the humpback chub.
The lower reach, so in the LCR there's the lower reach and the upper reach we talk about, and they're divided by this series of travertine-like waterfalls. And above the waterfalls, the water's actually pretty much clear, and there isn't that calcium carbonate deposition, which is really fascinating, that it can be so extreme and it's separated by these like waterfalls, you know.
And the fish like that turbidity, right? They like that. They like the sediment load in there or whatever.
Yeah. And I think, well, and that's part of, we're kind of like trying to tease out all these different factors with the fish. Because with like a species like the humpback chub, for example, if you're looking at like what kind of external factors might be driving their population, there's like what we would say bottom up and then also top down. So the really easy top-down example is thinking about in the cold, clear water, when you introduce predators like rainbow trout, you know, they can have a big impact on species because turbidity for the native fish is like a kind of a shield from predation. When you introduce a species like rainbow trout, that fish is by sight, you know, and relies on that clear water. So that's like a top-down impact. And then my research kind of started dealing with bottom-up impacts. Kind of the background, starting in 2003, Arizona Fish and Wildlife researchers started taking, because the humpback chub, their populations declined during the 1990s, and starting in 2003, Fish and Wildlife started taking humpback chub from, but anyway, so Fish and Wildlife took fish from the mouth or from the lower reach, and they put humpback chub in the upper reach, and they've been doing that study and have observed that they grow faster up there. And so that's kind of the incentive for the work that I was part of, is figuring out like, okay, why? So someone is looking at like macroinvertebrates, so like food base, like what, you know, it seems like there's more bugs up there. Someone is looking at light, which is related to both turbidity, like in clear water, yeah, like the fish could be maybe preyed on, or the fish might not prefer it as much, but the algae prefer clear water. So thinking about just like food availability related to light. And then I was looking at food availability related to phosphorus.
Okay.
Humpback chub growth models on the main stem, a lot of them, or most of them, they find really that like the two really predominant factors that seem to, you know, strongly describe humpback chub growth rates are temperature and food availability. And so people have done research on temperature with the LCR because right now most of the perennial water in the LCR is coming from a spring. And there's times of year when actually the water coming out of, you know, the water in the upper reach that's closer to the spring is actually warmer than the water in the lower reach closer to the river, which is counterintuitive because you think during the summer the water's getting heated up the more it's outside. But there's a lot of the year where it's actually warmer up there. And so, you know, there's, you know, it's likely that that's like part of the explanation for they're growing faster up there because it's more, you know, consistently warmer. And then, yeah, we were looking at this food-based thing because it has been established in other places that, so I was looking at phosphorus as a limiting nutrient. Once you explain it, it's intuitive, but it's not necessarily like limiting, like, what do you mean?
And phosphorus is available in the lower reach, but not the upper reach.
Well, it's available in both places, but I like to explain limiting nutrient, like, especially this time of year, like you're mailing out holiday cards or something.
Yeah.
So you have your like cards, your envelopes, and your stamps, and whatever you have the fewest of is gonna determine how many you can send.
Right.
So if you have like 400 cards but 20 envelopes and 20 stamps, you're only gonna be able to send, you know, 20 kind of complete packages. So I was kind of looking at, you know, whether phosphorus and nitrogen are kind of like, in most ecosystems, those are the two limiting nutrients that people look at when they look at nutrients, or those are like the really common ones, which I think we also kind of intuitively know agriculturally, like when you add fertilizer, you're adding those things. So to study that, I wasn't taking like samples of, I wasn't measuring how much phosphorus is here. In terms of the upper and lower reach, so the lower reach has all this calcium carbonate and it's this chalky turbid, and the upper reach doesn't. And research in other streams in Arizona has, and other places in the world, has pretty well established that phosphorus tends to co-precipitate with calcium carbonate. So it's not part of the chemical reaction, but it's just really sticky. And so it just tends to like leave the water column in the presence of calcium carbonate.
Interesting.
So then that led us to the hypothesis that like, okay, well maybe because of that, the lower reach is more phosphorus limited than the upper reaches, which could be, you know, like a bottom up kind of control on production. So like a control on how much resources do the algae have, which would then be how much resources do the bugs have, and then the fish, kind of like that.
Cool. It's a larger study involving trying to figure out why growth rates are higher in the upper reach by looking at food availability, limiting nutrients. What were you physically collecting in terms of data when you were trying to understand phosphorus as a limiting nutrient?
Yeah, the data collection was a really fun part of the study because in the Little Colorado is just such a unique environment that kind of the traditional methods weren't available to us, so we got to be kind of creative and troubleshoot and stuff. But normally when you're studying a limiting nutrient, you know, like in a pond behind your house or something, you would use a method called nutrient diffusing substrata. So I did this in Vermont the semester that I was just looking at data from the LCR. I got to do this little mini field portion to kind of test the method that we were planning on using against the traditional method. Yeah. So the traditional method, you take these like little cups with a clip lid, almost kind of like a pill bottle, and you like drill a hole in the top, and then you fill the cup with like an agar jelly treated with either nothing or treat like added nitrogen, added phosphorus, a combination. In Vermont, we were in Vermont in the fall, so we put like leaves on there, but you could normally you'd put like a little glass plate basically, and then you like put it in the stream and you like grow algae and see I guess which one grew the most algae, because the idea with the limiting nutrient, like with the, you know, holiday cards, like you have 20 cards, 40 envelopes, and 50 stamps, but let's say like someone, like I don't know that, so I'm adding, like let's say I add 10 more stamps and see does the card production increase. And so the idea is if you add more of the limiting nutrient, you would see you know, that algae grow more because you've like given it
right
that thing that it
but
needs.
But if it doesn't grow a lot more,
then it's like, oh, that wasn't the limiting nutrient. Something else. It has plenty of, right? Like,
and what's the time frame of that?
I left mine for, I think, 2 weeks. Uh-huh. And then it like started snowing and stuff. So I had to, and there was like this, normal field work stuff happened.
Yeah.
But so that's the kind of traditional method. What we did in the LCR, because in the Little Colorado River, in the lower reach, that calcium carbonate is depositing so quickly that you couldn't leave something like that out for even, you know, 2 days. It would get covered up.
Yeah.
You know, so you can. So what we did was we took these like really light, like the kind of clearest ones we could find, these the huge kind of like Nalgene water bottles, mm-hmm. like the 2.5 liter ones or whatever. And we took those and half of those. So we created 4 treatment groups.
Okay.
So half of those water bottles, we hiked into the upper reach of the Little Colorado River and, you know, filled up. We left a little, you know, called it headspace or like air at the top, but we filled it up pretty much with, you know, the river water from up there and some of the sediment from up there. So that's our upper reach samples. And then we did the same in the lower reach. So now we have an upper group and a lower group. And then half of each of those we spiked with phosphorus. Okay. So we added phosphorus, and then I had an oxygen and a light and a temperature sensor in there.
Okay.
And so then we hiked everything back to camp, and then I just like left them in the river for 10 days.
Okay.
And then opened them up, dumped them out, turned off the sensors, and then back at school in Vermont, downloaded all the data and stuff. So that's kind of how the data collection went.
Nice.
Yeah.
So the sensors are the key piece you take back to the lab.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And are you guys still in the middle of this, or have you had some conclusions from this study? We'll start with your part, and then on the greater questions.
Yeah.
What results have you gotten?
I've completed my part because I graduated, so I like had to be done. But so with my part, with kind of the phosphorus, so what we were looking for was, you know, in the upper reach and the lower reach, was there an impact? So basically, I guess with the sensors, the data that we got was oxygen, dissolved oxygen data. So if you have algae that are photosynthesizing a lot, you're going to have more dissolved oxygen, you know, kind of output, because that's how they respire. So we were we were looking at that to then using a computer program to model what we call gross primary production. So kind of like, I guess, how much photosynthesis is happening, like how much the algae are kind of photosynthesizing.
Okay.
So what I was looking for was, did adding phosphorus across the board, you know, kind of create a significant change in GPP, gross primary production? And was there a difference in that change between the upper and lower reach? And my data got kind of limited because during the field, like, 2 different kind of floods came through, which changed the turbidity because my bottles were all incubated in the river. So the first flood, it was kind of like the light gray. So I kept the data from that. And then the second time the flood came, it was just like pitch black, dark milkshake, you know. So I was like, okay, we can't
use that.
But so right now I have my data kind of parsed into pre-flood and post-flood. So it's kind of limited in that way in terms of, instead of 10 days like we might have gotten, there's like 4 days that we're looking at. And it's funny because it's like I have 4 replicates, which is not a lot and not robust, but was also the very much the best I could do.
It is what it is.
And it's like we had to fit everything in a rocket box.
No more.
It was like the most puzzle packed. But I found that adding phosphorus, so phosphorus is a limiting nutrient, there was a significant change in GPP in both the upper and the lower reach. But I was not able to really quantify that there's like more phosphorus limitation between the reaches. if that makes sense. So basically we can say like phosphorus, you know, is in some way controlling or affecting GPP and kind of the food base, the bottom of the food chain in the LCR, in the upper and the lower reach. But we're not able to say, oh, the lower reach is more phosphorus limited or the upper reach is more phosphorus limited. Hopefully as the rest of the study kind of comes together, it might become more clear. And I think it is a really interesting question. I mean, I'm glad I worked on working on a little piece like this. I think you're able to kind of focus on, I think with biology and I think with studying such dynamic ecosystems, I'm really fascinated by, or I think it's really interesting to think about like just asking the right questions and then asking the right questions at the right scale, especially with the LCR. Like if you think about phosphorus or just nutrients, especially having the flood during our study, it was very, you know, top of mind. That's like when a flash flood is coming, it's bringing all kinds of nutrients through. It might be like evening out the water chemistry between the upper and lower reach, or evening out the turbidity between the upper and lower. Like there's all these different things happening. So really what I have is like a point in time, you know, all my water was in bottles. So even when the flood came, I was still looking at water from before.
For sure, yeah.
You know, so it's just interesting to kind of like, okay, well, this thing alone isn't explaining it. But if you're thinking about it from the perspective of a fish, I mean, as much as we can, it kind of changes completely in terms of like the fish doesn't necessarily care about phosphorus. But there might be other impacts, or like thinking about like macroinvertebrates, when you have all that calcium carbonate, it's like there's less phosphorus, but there might also be like less stream bed stability, or like, you know, different habitat or things not related to nutrients that are related to the calcium carbonate that could be affecting things. So yeah. I think there still could be, I think the phosphorus thing will still be important as like the rest of the pieces come together.
You've kind of said, okay, at this point, we can't say phosphorus for sure is a limiting factor.
Or at least not alone. Like phosphorus alone
yeah.
isn't really explaining this difference in fish growth rate that we're seeing.
Do you have any goals or ambitions to go back and study another piece of this puzzle?
I think I would like to keep studying. I mean, like my whole life, I've always kind of been interested in biology and bugs and birds and plants and stuff.
Yeah.
And I really liked kind of learning it, like all my classes and readings. And I really kind of like this aquatic thing. And I feel like that's a really nice, I guess, kind of like a marriage, if you will,
yeah.
between what I like academically like to do and what I personally like to do.
Exactly.
In terms of just like standing in rivers.
What a beautiful, beautiful laboratory, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think I would hope to, I mean, and part of this, I got to do field work on the LCR, which is always just like an amazing place to be. So I definitely want to stay in the loop.
The Little Colorado River is a culturally and spiritually important place. It has been home to many for generations. From its headwaters high in the White Mountains to the depths of the Grand Canyon, the Little Colorado River relies on snowmelt runoff and spring water from its tributaries in order to give life to plants, animals, and people in the Southwest. Indigenous peoples have forever lived along the Little Colorado. It connects White Mountain, Apache, Zuni, Hopi, Dene, Paiute, Havasupai, Wallapai, and many other tribes to each other and to the Grand Canyon.
The LCR, as much as indigenous people and conservationists and biologists have established it as this really important place, it is also still, I guess, quote unquote, under threat in some ways.
Right.
So there was the big Escalade project where people wanted to put, I guess, a gondola or kind of down into the confluence, and there's still some proposals about some like dams and things at different
yep.
places. Big scope or thinking about continued work on the LCR and stuff. It is just an important ecosystem for people to keep trying to understand and trying to protect and things, because we're entering this period where things are just going to be changing with the dams, and we don't necessarily know how or when or in which ways. Mm-hmm. You know, that's there's a lot of unpredictability. The LCR has a really good track record, yeah, of just being that, yeah, I guess kind of like safe ground or like kind of that last stronghold for the humpback chub.
Yeah.
And a lot of native fishes. So it seems like, well, with all that stuff that's going on, at least like focusing on keeping that ecosystem intact is like an easy thing.
Yeah.
You know, scientifically, that's like, that just makes across the board. Yeah. Let's just do that.
Well, Phoebe, thank you for talking with Science Moab, and I really wish you luck and hope you get back into studying the humpback soon.
Yeah, thank you.
To learn more or listen to other Science Moab episodes, visit sciencemoab.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Our theme music is by Jeremy Spaulding, and the show is produced by Peggy Hodgkins, Christina Young, and KZMU. If you love Science Moab, let us know. Leave a rating on Spotify or a review on iTunes. And consider supporting Science Moab by donating to the podcast at sciencemoab.org. This programming is unique to Moab, Utah, and your support makes it possible.